So, welcome, Mandisa. It's an honor to have Mandisa Mbali with us today in our first podcast for the project Global Histories of HIV and AIDS Activism. We are going to discuss with Mandisa some of the key aspects of Mandisa's work, but also their broader social impact, social significance. I would like to start by introducing Professor Mandisa Mbali. Mandisa Mbali is an associate professor in historical studies at the University of Cape Town. Her main research interest is in health policy and activism, considered historically as interrelated phenomena both transnationally and within South Africa. Mandisa Mbali has explored this theme in book chapters and journal articles on AIDS activism and policies, health, gender and sexuality, and the politics of race and ethics in international health. In 2013, she published her scholarly monograph, South African AIDS Activism and Global Health Politics, with Palgrave Macmillan as part of their Global Ethics series. And we are very glad that the book is also on paperback, and it's been a reference point for our project. So it's really great that you are with us today, Mandisa. Shall we start with the questions?
Yeah.
Lovely. So, zooming in on your monograph on South African AIDS activism, you are using the notion of moral capital. So I was wondering whether you would like to elaborate on this concept and why it is important for your analysis, please.
Sure. So I was reading Christopher Brown's book on the history of abolitionism of slavery in the United States and Great Britain. And he uses the term moral capital, and that's what got me onto the whole idea. So a different way of putting it is what you're talking about when you talk about how activists in social movements try to generate and capitalize on moral capital, really is moral legitimacy. So that is the worthiness of the cause. And what you see with reference to AIDS activism is that the Treatment Action Campaign used the support of Nelson Mandela, you know, who opposed AIDS denialism and was in support of a rollout of HIV treatment, to generate the legitimacy of the movement. But also when activists smuggled fluconazole, a drug that was way too expensive, that was used to treat old thrush, into South Africa, what they did, and this was sort of clandestine, is they referred to it as the Chris Moraka Defiance Campaign. And that was referencing the Defiance Campaign of the 1950s, where Nelson Mandela and others broke the laws around segregation. So it was referencing those examples of anti-apartheid activism. Also, if we look at theorists of social movements like Charles Tilly or Sidney Tarrow, what we see is that social movements sort of have these master frames. So they don't reinvent the wheel, activists. There's previous examples of activism that have social traction, and they almost riff off these. But it goes further in that activists often have networks with other activists based on prior social movements. So it's almost like there are families of activism, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. And speaking of families of activism, one of the various very important for us and in general points or dimensions of your work is the transnational appeal influence of South African AIDS activism. So I would like to ask you about these, whether you could like to focus on some key aspects of this transnational or global, actually, appeal of South African AIDS activism, please.
I think it has boiled down to the fact that the movement generated in South Africa some symbols that were very powerful. So the HIV positive T-shirt, but I think also that it was partly around the charisma of activists like Zaki Ahmed, who was very vocal in speaking out against pharmaceutical industry greed when the entire, you know, multinational global pharmaceutical industry, that is all the corporations based in the global north, sued the Mandela administration to try and block the passage of the Medicines Act with the goal of blocking, you know, production of generic medicines in South Africa. So I think Ahmad's charisma, but also things like before the Barcelona International AIDS Conference, at the Barcelona International AIDS Conference, he gave an address where he was AIDS ill. And he was AIDS ill because he resolved not to take antiretrovirals until they were rolled out across South Africa. So that kind of act was like morally heroic. It was kind of going above and beyond what might be deemed to be necessary. And he took that step precisely to show that the cause was worth putting something on the line for. But I think it's also, as much as I think South African AIDS activism is important, I also don't want to be too South Africa-centric. There are people like, for example, Ugandan physician Peter Mugyenyi, who played a very important role in terms of pushing for a rollout of antiretrovirals, particularly, you know, through his connections with American AIDS activists. Or I really also think that the work of Indian AIDS activists has been incredibly important in relation to looking at, for example, drug patenting, trying to prevent the practice of evergreening. So I really admire Indian human rights lawyers. And there were these links that were forged, particularly around the international AIDS conferences, which activists capitalised on to build international networks. So as much as I admire South African AIDS activism, have documented it, have sometimes participated in it, I don't want us to be chauvinistic about it. It's an example of activism in a movement that was global in character.
Thank you very much. Yes, absolutely. And the connections actually also within the Global South between activists in various countries are also really insightful and important to study. Speaking of which, I was also wondering about a methodological parameter of your work. You reflect also in the introduction about one's positionalities and how they may influence one's work on the history of HIV and AIDS activism. So how important do you find this self-reflection, and why, if I may ask?
Yeah, I mean, it's relevant. I mean, part of my position actually is that there were members of my family who passed away from HIV, which was part of where the passion and the energy came from. I also think my positionality is that I've been quite privileged in terms of my education. You know, and I tried to capitalise on being a university student to really push for a rollout of antiretrovirals. There's another thing, which is campuses. They provide a really important space in terms of organising around gender and sexuality. So, for example, it is well known in terms of queer history research that student organisations have provided very important spaces for, as it was then termed, you know, gay and lesbian activists to, you know, organise, and for space for people to come out and to express themselves from a gender identity or sexual orientation standpoint without fear. And so I think that campus, you know, when I was involved in AIDS activism, provided that sort of space. But also now, later, being an academic, you know, I do have resources to write about the history of HIV activism. But I think my relationship with my writing has kind of changed over time, in as much as when I was younger, I was much more involved in activism. So the latter parts of the book perhaps were more ethnographic in character and dealing with quite contemporary events, whereas the earlier part of the book, I think perhaps is more classically a work of history. But the interesting thing is with time, the stuff dealing with the early 2000s is actually more classically historical, as it were. But I definitely think positionality matters a great deal in terms of how historians write. But it's complicated because sometimes if you go too far down that wormhole, so for example, with autoethnography and life writing, it has its place, but it can end up just being like self-reflecting on self, a bit like Escher's hand drawing hand. So you're not talking about phenomena outside yourself and using that space and time you have to write to think yourself into another time period or into other people's subjectivities, own experiences, social institutions and so on. You're just writing about yourself. And in a South African context, this has sometimes morphed into whiteness studies. So where people kind of talk about, white people talk about how they feel guilty about their own privilege and how upsetting it is. So sometimes if you write about, as a researcher, about your own dilemmas as a researcher, and that's all you're writing about, it becomes quite narcissistic and self-indulgent. Mm-hmm. And actually, in the case of whiteness studies, can end up reinforcing privilege. And, you know, I feel like I'm keen to shine a light on the experiences of oppressed people, not myself.
Well, that's a very important point. Thank you very much, Mandisa, for highlighting this, and something definitely we need to keep in mind when going on with this project. But now let me hand over to Mbali, please.
Mandisa, what dimensions in the history of HIV activism in South Africa warrant further analysis?
You know, I think first up, women's AIDS activism would be a top priority for me. I think there's a lot of things that need to be documented, like the work of the Positive Women's Network, the International Community of Women Living with HIV, or ICW. There were a lot of sort of organisations and activists in that period whose work was under-documented. Now, part of it is because of sexism that existed in AIDS NGOs, and even, I would argue, within movements like the Treatment Action Campaign in those days. To talk specifics, you know, a lack of women in leadership positions, you know, women's voices often being marginalised, and there was actually like an internal struggle within AIDS NGOs and the HIV treatment access movement for women's voices to be amplified more. But part of it is also a function of like the media. They like focusing on particular individuals, and even though Zaki himself back in the day and even now would emphasise that he was part of a movement and it wasn't all about him, the media loves zoning in on one person. They love heroes and like people who stand out, versus there were other people at the time who were also doing very important work, but who weren't, you know, as recognised or amplified. But I think that was addressed in later years at the international AIDS conferences, but not so much in terms of global media. Like, you'll have more coverage. So, for example, Annie Lennox, let's say, her work around HIV/AIDS has been emphasised. She's a global pop star, she's a celebrity, she's well known, like in the global north, versus someone like Promise Mtembu, who's been tireless, who's living with HIV, who's incredibly articulate and speaks directly to the issues. She, someone like her, does not get that much attention, if you see what I'm saying.
Thank you very much, Mandisa. And if I may move now to the issue of scholars from various parts, actually from the Global South. To what extent and in what ways are there structures on or practices in global research networks that restrict the participation of scholars from the Global South in terms of conferences or circulation of publications?
Okay, so there's one thing that I've highlighted in the past, particularly in my introduction to the special issue of Global Public Health that I co-authored with Jessica Russell, where we talked about the issue of article processing charges. So this move to open access journals, it sounds wonderful on paper because, you know, which scholar has not had the frustration of trying to download an article? And then what you find is you have to be a subscriber and sign in, and either you don't have the money to be able to access that article, or your institution does not subscribe to it. So open access sounds lovely. Everyone can access all articles. But then if you work backwards, what the journals have been doing, or rather, let me say, the publishing firms like Elsevier and so on, what they've been doing is charging authors fees to publish their articles. Now, these fees are not minuscule. They are huge sums of money. Like, so for me, for example, being a researcher based at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, I'm talking it's multiples of what a PhD student would have to pay in fees at our institution. So it's not like my institution is going to say, okay, so we're going to fund less PhD students so that Mandisa and Bali can publish an article in Global Public Health or BMJ, you know, Global Health and so on and so forth. So this is completely wrongful, and it goes beyond the issue of Africans and people from middle-income countries being able to publish in these global health journals. It's also a matter of, for example, let's say an independent researcher or a postgraduate student in the UK, and now there's funding cuts in, for example, the humanities, higher education funding sector everywhere is under pressure at the moment. So, you know, the idea that so much research money should go to these multinational publishing companies is completely questionable, and actually I would say wrongful in terms of social justice, and also, frankly, academic freedom and the right to science, the right that everyone has to access the fruits of scientific knowledge, which is something that UNESCO you know, promotes and has been defined by them. But there are efforts, I think, interestingly enough, in relation to clinical medical research. So I learned recently about the Africa Clinical Research Network, and what they're trying to address is the legacy of extraction of scientific knowledge from Africa. So Africa being used as a living laboratory, so data being extracted from Africa, taken to the global north, used to produce knowledge that doesn't then benefit Africans. So some of the worst example would be the history of Africans participating in clinical trials and then that medication not being made available to Africans afterwards. So basically, a colloquial way of putting this is like Africans being treated like guinea pigs, or scientists capitalising on weak regulatory or ethical frameworks in African contexts to like exploit Africans. So rather emphasising, number one, African scientists, they should drive the research agenda. Number two, the research agenda, part of the reason why this is the case is that clinical research should address African health needs, that these are understood very well by clinicians and scientists on the ground. Moreover, patients are not should not just be exploited, patients should benefit from the fruits of this scientific research. And finally, that also you need for there to be, we need to have health sovereignty in Africa as regards clinical research. So that's going places in terms of biomedical and public health research. I think where the issues perhaps become a bit knottier in a way and hard to find, something I have yet to work out is how all this works in relation to the humanities and social sciences. Because things like not exploiting your key informant, if you're doing ethnographic research, a lot of things can happen in the field, like in real time. And there are these power imbalances that you can't get rid of. And so sometimes what anthropologists end up doing is kind of a bit of bricolage, making up things as they go along and trying their level best to do right by their key informants. But that power imbalance does exist, and it's not easy to sort it out. Putting on my historian hat, because I'm an anthropologist and a historian, as a historian, I feel that in a way, when you're dealing with archival evidence, for me, there's less like ethical conflict or considerations, in as much as it's publicly accessible, the person has granted their consent for the archives to be made available. But I think something I'm concerned about is there can, just to circle back more directly to unequal participation in global research networks, I feel that we need to have more research conferences happen in the global south. A, because it's more affordable. B, just if I may humbly suggest, Cape Town is a nice place for Scottish people to visit when it's cold and dark here in Scotland. So you're very welcome to come to visit Cape Town for conferences. But also I feel things like, let's take digital humanities. It sounds really nice and really swish, but then there were questions about, okay, so if African archives are now digitized, could you end up with a situation where European and American researchers just stop visiting Africa? But then for us, there's so much knowledge that comes from oral history interviews and from being in the place. It's difficult to explain, kind of soaking it all up, engaging with people, you know? Yep. That it'd be a real problem if our like archival resources are just sort of reduced to being understood as bits of data rather than like reflections of human experience. As for artificial so-called intelligence, I'm not sure where all of that's going to lead, where the large language models are going to take us in terms of making research networks unequal. But I think we really need to reflect on things. You can't just adopt the new kind of shiny new research toys and expect them to be a magic bullet. We really have to think carefully about how we engage with each other. But there's also a further point that in the global north there are also various conflicts and inequalities. So for example, here in Scotland and in the UK, there are people who are undocumented migrants who maybe are postgraduate students or colleagues or also undergraduates at your institutions. There are black and ethnic minority people at institutions, and then obviously LGBTIQ people. So there are tensions and inequalities among people from the global or based in the global north. So I'm reluctant for us just to say there's a split. There's these inequalities in global north, these inequalities in global south. It's complicated terrain.
No, definitely, which brings us to our next question about how reflecting on the medical humanities and the history of HIV activism, how can it stir reflection on narratives used by global health organizations and whether those narratives may reinforce perhaps inequalities in the global south, but also within the global north. So let me hand over to Lesejo, please.
Oh, it's been great talking to you, Mbali. I think I wanted to ask you is like, what are the key challenges at the moment facing people living with HIV in South Africa? And what are the aims to end HIV transmission by 2030 in South Africa?
Well, I mean, something I'm deeply worried about is, frankly, the abolition of USAID and the decimation of PEPFAR, which basically was done at the stroke of a pen last year. Yeah. There was no opportunity for African health ministries or even civil society organisations to plan, to prepare. And in South Africa, this meant that clinics were forced to close, such as OUT and those run by the WITS Reproductive Health Institute. And thousands of community health workers and activists who were employed, you know, in terms of PEPFAR-funded projects, lost their jobs. Then I have also read about data capturers losing their jobs. Yeah. More on that in a minute. And then what I'm also very concerned about is the need for African health ministries to then step up to make up this deficit. But first up, let me return to the topic of the LGBTIQ health services that I wanted to discuss. So what I wanted to say is that in a South African context, despite the fact that we have the right to non-discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation, and also, so that is outlawed, and so is gender discrimination, what we see is that South African society is characterised by homophobia, transphobia and sexism. These are dominant societal norms. And unfortunately, in our health system, this plays out. So, for example, what you might well find is that a transgender person goes to a clinic in South Africa, a public sector health clinic, and is denied access to HIV care, you know, in a way that, because of transphobic stigma and discrimination. Another scenario could pertain to a sex worker not being able to receive HIV prevention or treatment services without that stigma and discrimination, you know, that sex workers can experience. So these programs were, you know, had a track record in terms of providing HIV-related prevention and treatment services to these types of members of most at-risk populations, also known as key populations. Now, these are populations where, unfortunately, because of homophobia, transphobia, and sexism, they're is a very high rate of HIV infection. So, therefore, services tailored specifically to their needs have been demonstrated by public health researchers to be really important in terms of not only reducing HIV infections, but also reducing HIV-related sickness and death in these population groups. So this really matters at the moment because there's this new injectable ARV called lacanopavir. And what it does is it's really effective in preventing HIV transmission. And the really neat thing is that a person only has to use it twice a year. So one shot twice a year. So it's not like taking pre-exposure prophylaxis, where somebody has to take the tablet every day. They just have to do it twice a year. So for us who are interested in eradicating HIV transmission, this is the most exciting development ever. Mm. In a way, it kind of is the closest we've got so far to something approximating an HIV vaccine, which would still be the ideal solution because it would be, you know, one injection, then one is, yeah, you know, protected for life. But lacanopavir, you know, is better than the oral PrEP was. So the scientists have made this massive breakthrough, but the scary thing is that this infrastructure, this scaffolding to roll it out to key populations, the scaffolding has been decimated. So these community health workers and activists who, you know the sex workers, the LGBTIQ people who are vulnerable to HIV, heck, who often, in fact, come from the same groups. So they're not outsiders. They're very familiar with the challenges and even effective approaches that can be developed by and for, you know, these communities. Those people aren't there anymore, or the clinics, such as they may have reopened, are inadequate. Now, this whole issue, so this relates to the PEPFAR and USAID cuts. There's a deeper issue here for me, which is that in 2001, there was a meeting of the African Union where African Union member states agreed to spend 15% of their health, but their national budgets on health. Now, this Abuja declaration, to this day, only two African countries have actually adopted this declaration. Now, the days when we can count on American funding to fund our health needs, unfortunately, those are over. Now's the time for African governments to step up to the plate and actually to spend adequately on health. But there's a second prong to this whole health financing problem, which is the issue of corruption and illicit financial flows on the continent of Africa. So according to the African Development Bank, the continent loses $580 billion annually in illicit financial flows, which vastly outstrips the foreign aid that we receive for global health. So then this takes us back to a matter which we need to take in our own hands as Africans, and that is to combat corruption, mismanagement and criminality in our own societies. And this is not something that Europeans or Americans or anyone else can do for us. We've got to do it ourselves, right? But I think something that would also be complicated from now onwards is a particularly, I don't like cold weather, but a particularly chilly wind that faces African AIDS activists, which, I mean, there's a lot of resilience and strength, so I don't think it's impossible, is going to be retaining the funding for LGBTIQ health services in an African context, but ensuring it's state funded. Yeah. That's going to be hard, but it has to be done. Mm-hmm. So we need to see what's going to happen, but I think if we're going to have health sovereignty on our continent, it needs to be funded, you know, domestically. Now, in a South African context, I want to provide a concrete example, namely Tembisa Hospital, which has been looted, you know, through these corrupt tenders and contracts, mm-hmm. to the extent that an accountant who is a whistleblower in terms of the theft at that hospital, Bobita Deokaran, was brutally assassinated to try to silence her. But also, we currently have the Madlanga Commission of Inquiry into police corruption. And at the moment, barely a day goes past that there isn't a further revelation of police corruption. And the corruption at Tembisa Hospital has also come up recently. So I don't talk only in general terms about the continent. It's a serious issue within South Africa, yeah. itself.
Mandisa, thank you so much for sharing those insights with us from your work, but also its broader relevance for research and health policy. We would now like to conclude the recording, and we'll send this to you to check. And yeah. It's great. Thank you very much once again for the opportunity you gave us to discuss with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It was lovely talking to you and just learning a lot, you know. I think when we talk about all of these issues, as you've stated, that South Africa in activism history of HIV, it's part of it. It's not just should be focused on it. So yeah, it was just great having your opinions and your knowledge sharing with us. So thank you.